Before we proceed with the second case, I would like to point out in the program that we had printed up that all of our cases are carried live on our homepage and that they are also archived so that you can listen to them at a later date. And on page 35, nearly at the end of the booklet, there is the website for listening to those arguments. If you hear of an argument in the future that interests you that's coming up, you simply can bring up this website or you can use the archive factor. Also, for many years, we have been faithfully served by Mr. Herb Fickbaum of the media service here at the University of South Dakota. He's done an excellent job for us, and this year will be Herb's last year with us. He is retiring, and we would like to thank him for all his years of accommodating us as we come down here every March. The second case for oral argument is the estate of Lila Kramlich, and for the appellants, Mr. H.I. King, an attorney from Aberdeen, and for the appellees, Mr. Kenneth L. Gosch, an attorney also from Aberdeen. Mr. King, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court, contestant, counsel. My name is H.I. King, and I represent the contestants, Lois Baum, Jerry Baum, and Daniel Baum. The issue from which the contestants appeal is whether the trial court was clearly erroneous in concluding that Ms. Kramlich possessed the testamentary capacity necessary to execute her will and trust on July 14, 1998. We contest our burden of proving lack of testamentary capacity on the part of the deceased was met pursuant to statute. In evaluating the soundness of mind, this court has directed the lower courts not to look at one single moment in time, that would be the time of execution only, but to look or consider the condition of the testator's mind a reasonable length of time before and after the making of the will. It is the argument of the contestants that a reasonable period of time before the making of the will should begin at the time there occurred a tremendous and significant change in the cognitive abilities of the testator. Dr. Tello, her treating physician and internist from Bismarck, North Dakota, agreed that the testator's cognitive ability suffered a mega change after the stroke. A reasonable time after the stroke, we suggest the court consider, is approximately 35 days later or until Ms. Kramlich was medically diagnosed as suffering from severe dementia. It is understood that the soundness of mind should not be determined from a snapshot in time, and those are my words, but from a reasonable time. I think in the facts in this case, we can generally conclude a number of things. We assert, one, in mid-June, 1 month before signing the will and trust, Ms. Kramlich suffered a devastating stroke. Dr. Tello agreed that it had a significant effect on her cognitive abilities. Further, he testified, and this court heard or can read Dr. Tello's deposition, which this court takes a de novo review, but he testified her cognitive ability and status remained basically unchanged from mid-June until July 14th.
So you're saying there was no good days and bad days?
Well, no, respectfully what I'm saying is that Dr. Tello stated that when he looked at the patient care summaries and reviewed them, in direct testimony, he said she basically remained unchanged. On cross-examination, he said, well, there was improvement enough where she could go home. It's really unclear to me whether he was talking about an improvement to where she could go to assisted living. But the fact of the matter is that he testified that she remained unchanged, basically, in her mental condition. If there were good days and bad days, it was within the abilities that were mentioned in the patient care summaries.
So the good days weren't all that good.
That's what I'm trying to argue, Your Honor.
But Dr. Manlove came to the opposite conclusion.
Yes, he did. And Dr. Manlove, the expert in this case, for the proponents, basically relied upon, I believe, the testimony of three lay witnesses. He relied upon the testimony of Dolores Seiler, who was the driver and helper, who later became power of attorney, knew Lila Kramnik in the latter part of her life. He relied upon the testimony of Marvel Harder, who was the part-time social worker who was covering for someone gone at Med Center, who was instrumental, and that we argue prompted the signing of the will. And he relied upon, to some extent, Helen Kramlich, who was the mother of the people who were going, and grandmother of the beneficiaries of this will that was proposed.
And the medical records.
He stated he did rely upon those initially, but I believe the essence of his testimony presented to the court was that if these people are correct, she must have had good days where she was cognizant. And what he was referring to was, I believe, Dolores Seiler, who talked about how Ms. Kramlich referred to her will that the dust will fly when people find out about it. I made reference to a bill she was going to pay and not pay. Made reference to other matters that are really in flat contradiction to the medical records. So although Dr. Manlove says that he reviewed those medical records, I don't think he relied upon them. I think he relied upon, if you read his testimony, on those three lay witnesses.
But the trial judge also did, didn't he? The trial judge also relied upon those witnesses and came to the conclusion that Dr. Manlove was more correct than your expert.
I believe that's what the trial court, if I remember correctly, that is what he relied upon also. But the lay witnesses that were relied upon really testified, and including in addition to Dolores Seiler, Marvel Harder, Helen Kramlich, Attorney Grunewald, really relied upon, were really facts that were inconsistent with known medical records. What I suggest in arguing that she was not of sound mind is to use the unrefuted, or if that's a proper word, but the medical records developed by disinterested nurses who checked daily throughout the day the mental and cognitive abilities.
Well, wasn't Attorney Grunewald disinterested too? He had nothing to gain either way this case came out, did he?
That's correct. But if you would look at Attorney Grunewald's testimony, there are a number of problems with his testimony. And if I could, I would explain them. Attorney Grunewald, one, had a maximum exposure to Lila Kramlich from June until July 14th of about 20 minutes, and these records are before the court by records that he submitted, which are phone conversations. So he had very little contact, and when he testified, I think he said there was nothing that led me to believe that she wasn't of sound mind, if I could paraphrase his testimony. However, there was some things. He had notes of conversations with Dolores Seiler, where a stroke was mentioned, and with the social worker, where there were discussions with memory loss and other matters. There were no notes of his conversations with the testator. Mr. Grunewald's testimony is, my belief and our argument, is limited by the extent of what his exposure was in determining whether she was of sound mind, which by his own records is about 20 minutes since the stroke, or from the stroke occurred, if you added up the minutes of his conversation.
But doesn't any attorney who's going to draft these kinds of testamentary documents make an initial determination to satisfy himself or herself that this person's competent to sign a will or a trust or whatever?
I think they do, Your Honor. In this case, what is significant and difference is that he was in Milbank, South Dakota, that she was in a hospital under medical care in Bismarck, North Dakota. There isn't any record that he visited with her or saw her physically, visited with her personally, I should say.
Had she been using him as an attorney for a long period of time?
That's correct, Your Honor. He had used her for as an attorney for a long period of time, that he was contacted about making changes in the will, never contacted concerning excluding people in the will specifically through conversation or direct correspondence. He then received notes not covered with a introductory letter on removing or canceling the heirs in the former will. And then he had subsequent conversations with her, I believe in May, and then she had a stroke in the conversations he testified to at the court, which amounted to about 20 minutes in total.
Mr. King, normally in a fact-based situation like this, we give a lot of deference to the trial court. What's different about this? I mean, normally either the finder of fact as a jury or a trial judge, we would say we'll let them determine the weight and the credibility of the witnesses and then look at it, as you indicated earlier, clearly erroneous. What is it that you pinpoint here that we would reverse it on a factual finding?
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, the evidence that was presented, which allows the court a de novo review. Practically, the entire case of the contestants was the presentation of either medical testimony by deposition. Why? Because they were all in Bismarck, North Dakota, and this case was heard in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And the court can review all of those records de novo without deference to the lower court opinion. And two, there seems to be, and there is, a everyday record from mid-June until July 14th of the cognitive abilities of the testator, taken by nurses who are working, who are trained and taught to check the cognitive and perceptual abilities of her.
During what did they actually do? They don't come in and they're a nurse and say, do you know who your heirs are today? Do you know, Lila, what your assets are? I mean, they're just doing their job as medical technicians, aren't they?
That's true, Your Honor, but they ask more basic and more simple questions, and really the most simple questions of orientation that anybody should know. It is the testimony of the nurses that testified by deposition too. In this case, why? Because they were from Bismarck, and we could not make them come here without extraordinary cost. But they testified, what they did is they checked her cognitive abilities throughout the day, and they noted it, and they asked general orientation questions. Where are you? Who are you? What time is it? What day is it? And then the nurses testified that we didn't really need to know the exact time or the exact location. We just needed to know a general ability to respond. And there was not one day, if you look at those records, where confusion was not noted. Now, unlike other cases that the court has had where people are suffering from a psychosis, I mean, this was as a result of brain damage, according to Dr. Tello. And because of that brain damage, she was never going to go home again, and in fact did not go home. And unlike in the case, I think it's Hobelsberger, where this court talked about the extent of a stroke and dizzy spells being the extent of the questionable mental capacity, in this case, this court, and it's for your review and exclusive to draw your conclusions de novo, there were days she didn't know where she was, who she was, what time it was, and what date it was. And they testified that during these shifts, they checked throughout the day. What happens after she's discharged? What happens after discharge 2 days later, 3 days later, in the assessment at the assisted living, the registered nurse who did the nursing assessment had left blank long-term memory left blank. Short-term memory loss, yes. Called her a poor historian. Confused, I believe, to time, oriented to person and time, confused to place. This was on the 17th. If you are to believe the argument of the proponents, she suffers a devastating stroke, improves to a point at the apex on July 14th, enters executes a will and trust, then obviously she deteriorates. Why? Because she had to go to and have a psychological evaluation, which required, because of increased confusion. And then when she's finally diagnosed on August 20th, 35 days later, she's suffering from severe dementia. I believe the argument, Your Honor, when you first asked me that question, good days and bad days, I think it's good days and bad days within the realm of dementia. I don't believe, and I don't think it is a credible argument, and I think it's clearly erroneous to conclude that she was severely demented on August 20th because of the possibility that she had some treatment for her kidneys. And she would not have been if she had not. She would have been of a sound mind.
And in fact, this morning you've two or three times, specifically in response to Justice Meyer Henry's question, you've indicated that we can look at this differently because it's de novo review. How would you apply the recent amendments to Rule 52, which take away our power to give de novo review to depositions and documentary evidence?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm unfamiliar with Rule 52.
Well, it's the rule that requires us to give deference to the trial court's findings of fact. And it says that we cannot, the amendment says that we no longer utilize a de novo standard of review for documentary evidence and depositions and things of that nature.
Your Honor, that being the rule, the evidence still speaks for itself. And the court is entitled to review it. Whether the lower court made any, I'm not sure the lower court ruled in a specific way discarding that evidence, and I believe that the court can look at that evidence in the way it's presented. It isn't depositions the court may give deference, but not really, to the documentary evidence, because I believe they speak for themselves.
Mr. King, this is somewhat different in that she had, when prior to her stroke, very clearly written out in her own handwriting exactly what she wanted to do as far as the changes in her will. Isn't that right? And then the will then reflects her handwritten orders to her lawyer. So I guess my question is that at the point then when she actually signs the will, are you saying then she needs the capacity to remember verbatim what she had originally directed? Or is it could we find that she had enough testamentary capacity to know that she had directed him in a certain fashion and that those were her wishes and that she was signing the will as a direct result of those earlier directions when she clearly was competent?
Justice Meyer Henry, I believe the general rule applies that the court just must find and determine whether she was of sound mind for making the will, where if she can't without prompting. And in this case, she certainly was prompted to sign the will. Whether she was prompted to make a determination as to who her heirs would be, I don't think that's correct. But that will sat on the window seal, untouched, and left by her. It appeared to be opened. We don't know exactly by whom, but it was left open.
But she does actually add something to that will. She inserts a number, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was the testimony in this case. But my argument is, I think the evidence of what her directions were prior to her stroke is some evidence some circumstantial evidence that she acted in conformity with that desire. But that's all it is. It is not determinative, like I think the lower court determined that it was. And I know the importance of the intent of the testator in the court making its decisions. The fact of the matter is she suffered a devastating stroke. And as I argued at the lower court, we don't know if she was of unsound mind. We don't know if she would have excluded her only sister. We don't know whether she would have excluded her only sister's children and grandchildren and given everything to her deceased.
But that was that's exactly what she did in her notes in April and May. With 2 or 3 months before she signed this will, she specifically indicated to her lawyer that she did want to do those things.
What she indicated to her lawyer only was will heirs in will canceled. If I can remember, Attorney Grunewald's testimony was he never inquired on that portion of her desire. So certainly you can imply that that was to exclude her children or the children of her sister.
So you're saying there's a miscommunication here, that this is the sister being disinherited and her heirs was a miscommunication?
No, no, I'm not. Those were her notes. And she decided that what I'm arguing before the court is that I think it isn't as clear as the proponents would like. And in fact, it's kind of odd that she would write instructions with no cover letter, that there were no discussions. But no, I'm not arguing that it was a mistake. I assume probably and didn't argue that it wasn't her intention.
When she wrote those out, when she made her notes, you're not contending that she was incompetent at that time?
No. Although there is some evidence that there were problems from Dr. Brown's report of her suffering from, in a layman's term, hardening of the arteries, Dr. Tello testified that really he thought she was fine until the time of the stroke. Then at the time of the stroke, she suffered these great cognitive brain injury, explosions.
Your time has expired, Jack. You got about an extra minute out of us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Plus you get 10 more minutes later.
It's always my worry I'd go too short. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Gash.
May it please the court. I think it's important to look at the law. I had the benefit in this case of not being the lawyer who drew the will, not being the lawyer who was present when the will and trust were signed, so I had the opportunity to sit down and look at all the law before I began my investigation to see just exactly what the facts were. The first thing that jumped out at me was this court's prior rulings on competency. It was the contestant's duty to show that Lila had such a complete mental degeneration as denotes the utter incapacity to know and understand those things which the law prescribes as essential to the making of a will. Now, that seems like a rather large burden. So in my investigation, I set about to see just exactly what was going on. Talked to the lay witnesses who testified at trial. Looked at the medical records. Talked to the medical personnel, took their depositions. Looked for Lila's handwritten information prior to writing the will and her communications with her attorney, specifically looked at what her attorney said and did and the discussions he had with her. And then presented this case to the trial court. And as one of the justices already acknowledged, the trial court agreed with our side of the evidence, and so it's the contestant's burden now to show that somehow the trial court was clearly erroneous.
Isn't this almost the kind of a case, though, that's absolutely ripe for the attorney drawing the will to do something further? I mean, he's aware of her age, he's aware of the fact of the stroke, he does have the prior instructions, but he's aware that there's some disinheritance involved of a sibling and a sibling's children, and then he's aware that it's a pretty substantial matter, and he's probably aware it's going to be contested. So you know, why not do a video and do some proof of competency, you know, in an objective way that could be reviewed by the court? And is his absence of doing it, is that almost create some kind of a thinking that the results would not have been as favorable as the result of the trial court?
I don't think so. As you recall, in about 1972, my senior partner was up before the Supreme Court on the case of In Re Estate of Evans. And one of the things that the court pointed out there is that when the attorney himself thought the individual was incompetent, and in that case did make a tape recording or a video, I forget which, that was evidence that the attorney questioned competency and was worried about it himself. In this instance, Max Gruenwald was not worried about competency, and he wasn't worried for a number of reasons. He had the written instructions, he'd had telephone conversations with her, and on the day the will was executed, he called and talked to her for about 4.5 minutes before the will was signed. He talked to her at about 11:30, and the will was signed at about 1 or 2 o'clock, somewhere in that area. So under those circumstances, Max Gruenwald, in his testimony, was he didn't question her competency. He had had discussions with Marvel Harder over the telephone. He had talked to Lila over the telephone. Now, if Max had driven up to Bismarck and actually been personally present, I believe that would have helped. But he made a judgment, and I think correctly so, that based on his discussions, she was competent. He didn't need to do those things. So I think what it shows, the fact that they didn't do a tape recording or didn't do a videotape, shows Max's confidence in her competency.
Isn't dementia, though, don't you need to rely on the expert when someone is determining whether or not you have capacity under a dementia illness? Because in dementia, you can talk to someone and they can answer and you can think they're tracking and they really are not.
Yeah,
I may say, yes, that person understood, but in reality, they did not.
I deal with the elderly on a regular basis, and I understand what you're talking about. We wouldn't even be here today if Dr. Brown had done his job. Dr. Tello did his job, and you know, Dr. Tello's testimony was Lila had her good days and her bad days, but she made steady progress. On June 12th, she had a stroke. By June 15th, I took her out of the acute unit because she had recovered that much. By June 15th, I'd taken her out of the acute unit, and by July 15th, she was ready to be discharged from the hospital to go to assisted living. And Dr. Tello did not say that he was sending her to assisted living because she was mentally incompetent. His testimony was that she had a drop-off of her cognitive abilities from the time of the stroke, but that improved steadily, and that he sent her to assisted living because she was on dialysis and she couldn't take the travel back and forth. She was unsteady on her feet, and she needed some further assistance with rehabilitation. I don't believe the trial court agreed with counsel, and I thought it was misleading of counsel to present his testimony in such a fashion to try to claim that Lila was admitted to assisted living because she had this great brain problem. She had had a stroke. A lot of people have a stroke. You recover from a stroke. You do better after a stroke. And we wouldn't even be here if Dr. Brown had done his job. This patient was referred, I call him Dr. Brown, he's not even a doctor. He doesn't have a doctor of philosophy. He didn't have a medical degree. He's just a psychologist. He wrote this report, which caused Lila to be put in an Alzheimer's unit at the Chateau for a day when she was first admitted, until the medical personnel said, my goodness, this is ridiculous, and they moved her back over to the medical wing because they recognized that she was not incompetent, just as the trial court recognized she wasn't incompetent. And Brown was lazy. Brown was hired to treat Lila, and he sold out to the contestants in this case. He agreed to give a report to them in which he claimed, first, that Lila was incompetent even before she wrote her handwritten instructions. And when I deposed him, he wouldn't even admit that, although it was proven those were her handwritten records, that that showed that she knew what she was doing then. He still contended that she was totally incompetent at the time she made a detailed listing of her assets and at the time that she wrote out her detailed instructions on her will.
What are the trial court's findings as to credibility of Dr. Brown?
The trial court adopted Dr. Manlove's testimony. It did not make a specific finding that Dr. Brown was incredible. But as you see from the document, which I gave the heading, the debunking of Dr. Brown, that I attached as an appendix, he's totally unbelievable. He didn't interview any witnesses. He didn't do anything to corroborate his testing. He didn't know Lila had a difficulty seeing, even though his testing showed that on the areas of the test where she had to read, she did the poorest. He didn't look at the medical records. He looked at a couple of CT scans, but he didn't look at all of the medical records. He just jumped to these conclusions. And even worse than that, Dr. Tello, her treating physician, said, Lila had kidney dialysis, and when you have kidney dialysis, it really washes you out and makes you tired. So that's your worst day. You have the dialysis and you're worse then until the next day or so when you recuperate. So what does Dr. Brown do? He takes Lila from kidney dialysis across the hospital. There are the clinics next to the hospital. So you go through a hallway over to his office, puts her in a room and tests her after she has had kidney dialysis when she's at her weakest moment. And he makes no account of it. In fact, he didn't even know it. And then he says, well, she didn't know where she was at. And when I said, well, did she know she was at the hospital? I don't know. Well, what do you mean she didn't know where she was at? Well, she didn't know if she was in my clinic. Did anybody tell her they were taking her from the hospital over to his clinic? I don't know. I mean, Dr. Brown was totally unbelievable. The trial court rejected his testimony, as it properly should have, and relied on Dr. Manlove's testimony, because the opposite, Dr. Manlove, who this court has recognized as a forensic psychologist and recognized his ability in the Dockin case, looked at all of the medical records. Every one I could find, he looked at. He interviewed the lay witnesses. He attended the trial. He read all of the depositions. And after doing that, he offered his reasoned opinion and gave all of the reasons as to why he felt that Lila was competent, which included, you know, the fact that Lila was able to make a decision as to whether or not they should have an auction of her personal property. And she even says, well, I don't want you to use that auctioneer because he's a crook, so use this one. And Lila was able to make funeral arrangements. And it's kind of cute. Lila must have been a really remarkable person because she says, I don't want funeral director A to be my funeral director because he's my friend. I want him to come to my funeral as my friend, not as my funeral director. That's not an incompetent person. You're not suffering from severe dementia and have the ability to make those kinds of decisions. After the stroke, Lila gets into a dispute with her neighbor who tried to take over her affairs. Says, no, I don't want that. I want Dolores Seeler to be my attorney in fact. Gets him appointed, ends that problem. Dolores Seeler then regularly brings the bills up to the hospital, sits down with Lila, they go through them. Lila says, pay this one, don't pay that one. Give to this charity, don't give to that charity. Those are not the things, that, you know, according to Dr. Brown, this woman was so demented that she wouldn't have even recognized Lila, let alone be able to go through and pay her bills. Those are the kinds of things that the trial court had the ability to look at and decide what to do. Now, counsel would like to focus strictly on medical records without looking at the testimony of the people who created those records. in particular, the two nurses, when I cross-examined them, they admitted that they've had about 7 patients they're looking after, and they're busy in the hospital, and that they make an initial assessment early in the morning. But it's not at all unusual to wake somebody up early in the morning, particularly when they're elderly, and them to be a little bit confused and not know what time of day it is. In fact, it's getting easier for me to understand that the older I get. But they then go on in the records. The one nurse admitted, well, she even got confused as the dates and put the wrong dates in the record and had to admit that she had done that wrong. I mean, that's not a big deal. I think we've all done that. And then the nurses said that even if they were confused only once during the shift, wake them up in the morning and they weren't able to give you the time of day and the exact date it was, then they would put in the record confused at times. But even more significant than that, if we look at the time this will was signed, the only evidence we have is that she was not confused at that time. On July 14, 1998, the medical records in the morning at 7:15 when she was first awakened and asked, said confused at times. However, at 1 o'clock when the will was signed, Marvel Harder, who was a social worker with training in psychology, testified that she knew what time it was, she knew what day it was, she knew what year it was. She wrote in on the will without any prompting the day, the month, and the year that she signed her will and trust. And as one of you noted earlier, very significantly, I believe, she had to choose the number of years in the trust that a beneficiary would have to pay back a loan. She considered that on her own and wrote in the number 4 on her own with no prompting from anyone. Now, I don't know how a demented person could make a decision like that. I think that shows significantly that she knew precisely what she was doing at the time she signed this will. I was prepared to go on with some more about Dr. Brown's misgivings, but I'm going to pass on that. I just am so disgusted with his work and the way he treated Lila that I'm going to ignore him. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the lay witnesses. Usually in a will contest, the lay witnesses who testify are in some way interested. It's usually one of the beneficiaries. In the Hackett case, for instance, you had everything or most of the property given to one son, and the other kids eventually wound up with $200. Well, there you had half the kids lined up on one side says, nah, Mom was Looney Tunes. And the other kids said, no, Mom knew what she was doing. But they were interested. They had an interest in the outcome. In this particular case, Dolores Seeler was her friend. Dolores Seeler had medical training. She was a certified nurse's aide. Dolores Seeler works for a medical doctor, Dr. McDougall, in Aberdeen when he comes to Eureka. When she was working for Dr. McIntosh at the Eureka Hospital as a certified aide, part of her job was to work with elderly people to make sure they understood things and they got to where they wanted and got done what they wanted. Now, that person had no interest in this will, and she clearly testified Lila knew what she was doing, and she testified as to why Lila knew what she was doing. Then you have Helen Cromlich. Now, Helen Cromlich is not interested in the will, and she is the stepdaughter of Lila Cromlich's husband, the daughter of Lila Cromlich's husband, and Lila's stepdaughter. The only thing she got was a quarter of land that had been deeded to her a year before the will was done. And she got nothing under the will or the trust. She testified as to her conversations with Lila, coming up to the hospital to see her, Lila being in good shape, able to visit with her. Now, when I say good shape, physically she had had a stroke, she was on dialysis, and she was clearly having physical problems, but she was not having mental problems. And then you have Marvel Harder, totally disinterested social worker, saw her, Lila, 11 to 12 times while she was at the hospital, and had the opportunity to interact with her and get to know her well, and was present when the will was signed. And she had no problem with Lila's competency. The key issues here, did Lila know and understand the nature and extent of her assets? And clearly she did. Is this?
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Okay. Did she know and understand who her heirs were? Clearly she did. Did she want to make a disposition of her property? Clearly she did. And I want to close then by saying, I don't think there's any question that Lila was competent. After I had the opportunity to investigate, to try this case and to review everything, I know that what Lila wanted happened. As I told you earlier, I am really disgusted with psychologist Brown, and I'm really let down to think that people who are hired to treat this lady didn't do their job and resulted in all of these accusations of incompetency being made against this grand lady. Consequently, I ask you to affirm Judge Dobberpohl and to send this case back for execution of its judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gash. Mr. King, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Dr. Tello testified that he thought the testator needed some help after the stroke, not because of renal problems, but mostly because of the sequela of the stroke, the damage done to the brain by the stroke. It's in his deposition, I believe, at page 23. The argument of the contestants today before this court is basically there is a uninterested baseline of her mental competency from mid-June until the 20th of August, where she was diagnosed with severe dementia. Those are the medical records of the nurses. If you measure the use that as a baseline and you measure the testimony or judge the credibility of the testimony of Dolores Seiler, you'll find out that she's wrong. Her testimony contradicts almost every medical finding. Dolores is the person who testified. Ms. Seiler was the person who testified that Ms. Kramlich remained in Bismarck not because of damage to the brain, which Dr. Tello testified to, but because of the drive and the air conditioning. That's her testimony. That's her medical knowledge. Flatly contradicts the disinterested testimony of Dr. Tello. Her testimony regarding the mental abilities of Ms. Kramlich are contradicted by the medical records. This was a woman, and these records are before this court, that is noted confusion every day. And this confusion is to the most basic orientation questions. And if you look at the nurse's testimony, unlike the argument of counsel, the testimony is that they checked these cognitive perceptual abilities throughout the day. I'll let the testimony of the nurses speak for themselves, and that is before this court. But here she has, and then she talks to Attorney Grunewald and mentions, well, she had a stroke, and she seems to know where she's at, and she's okay. That's in flat contradiction to the testimony of Dr. Tello. Now, Dr. Manlove relies on that testimony. He doesn't rely, I believe, in his conclusions on what Dr. Tello says. I think he relies upon what Dolores Seiler said. I think her testimony further was confusing in reference to times. Call the court's attention to the famous quotation that when the family finds out, the dust will fly. On direct testimony, she said that occurred some days after the will. On cross-examination, she said it occurred sometime before the will was executed. And finally, on redirect, she said it was said twice. I think she was confused.
What are you saying she didn't say it? because that's a pretty telling statement. I mean, if she knows the dust is going to fly because of what she did, I mean, how can you argue with that not revealing she knew exactly what she was doing?
I'm not arguing that the substance isn't damaging to the contestant's case. It is. But Mrs. Seiler, who testified to that, stated in her redirect, her cross-examination, that it occurred sometime in May on the drives back and forth, clearly before the stroke. Then she testified on direct, that it occurred some 6 days afterwards. Then on redirect, she testified that it occurred both times. I don't think she knows when it occurred. And I think when I asked her on cross-examination about that story, I think it occurred in May, if it occurred at all. And that's the argument that I believe that Mrs. Seiler, and clearly, if the notes are correct, clearly she was excluding her sister and her sister's children before the will. And so would that be expected prior to the stroke? Yes. Is it totally unexpected after the stroke when looking at the medical records? I think it is, especially when it was done 4 or 5 days later, according to her direct testimony, and that's about the time of the nursing assessment. You look at Marvel Harder. Marvel Harder was a social worker that was filling in. Her contact was about 12 times. Her discussions were not that deep. Also, it appears that Marvel at least knew that she had to go in and do some prompting to get the testator to sign the will. I think when you look at the attorney Grunewald's testimony in reference to whether he believed she was of sound mind, he didn't have any reason. First of all, you have to look at, one, there seems to be some disinterest. There doesn't seem to be a follow-up of conversation or inquiry made as to her competency. He, even in his own testimony, said, when I talked to her, she seemed fine. Other than that, that's the limitation of his inquiry. And so whether his testimony is substantial when compared to the baseline, he had 20-minute conversations with her and really isn't the person to know. And I think if the court wants an accurate reflection of her mental and cognitive abilities, you would look at the medical testimony of disinterested parties, Dr. Tello, Dr. Brown, when he diagnosed her with severe dementia. Regardless of whether he rendered an opinion later on, he diagnosed her with severe dementia, not knowing anything about any potential lawsuit. So what we have is a terrible stroke. We have documented day-to-day disorientation to the both basic questions of life. We have her not being able to go home. We have her, even in the assisted living, obviously someone contacted the doctor and said, there's increasing confusion here. We can't take care of her. Now, that's not part of the record, but I think it's a reasonable inference from what happened. And then they had to set a time to have her diagnosed, and she was diagnosed of severe dementia. What opposing counsel forgets to tell you is that diagnosis remained unchanged. Now, he talks about Dolores Seiler again. Well, Dolores presented the testimony of that testimony, but Dolores Seiler was just wrong. And to say that she had medical knowledge, she was a nurse's aide in 1985, she did some work in the office for a doctor, and compared to the medical testimony of the nurses that were presenting and observing purposefully the cognitive abilities of this woman. And I believe that if the burden is upon the contestants, and the contestants went and got medical records and looked and said, wait a minute, this woman was diagnosed 35 days beforehand or after as suffering from severe dementia, that she finally discovered that she had a terrific stroke in mid-June. And it's the question of days, it's really unique in that approximately 1 month before signing and executing the will, she has a stroke. Her cognitive abilities are marked and checked daily. Now, unlike any of the facts in Hoglsberger where there were moments of absolute clarity, in these, they talked about confused at times was the best there was. One time within defined...
2 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. The reason that this is contested and before the court today is what I believe independent medical evidence of a severe damage to the brain of the contestant. I believe that the court has to look at the time when she executed the will and living trust that she was of sound mind. If she was of sound mind before the stroke, we concede that. We don't concede and believe she was not of sound mind. We believe that the best she could do is maybe know where she was at or who she was. And that was the extent of the discovery. To believe the arguments of the proponents of this bell curve where we reach the apex of her clarity on the day that she signs the will and that there's an improvement and then really what I believe is a clear deterioration. She goes into assisted living, increased confusion, diagnosis of severe dementia. That doesn't mean that severe dementia happened on August 20th. That's when it was properly diagnosed. And so maybe these witnesses and these lay witnesses, if you look at the medical evidence, not unlike Justice Meyer Henry said, is there might have been an appearance of clarity, but really there wasn't when you ask the most basic questions. We believe that the independent medical evidence supports that she was not of sound mind to execute her last will and testament and living trust. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. King. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.